Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
And good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. And as we speak, he's probably in the air, I would imagine, Vice President J.D. Vance, heading to Mitchell Field, very close to us, the 128th refueling wing at the airport there. And it is another visit. He was here 4 months ago in Plover, which is an area you know very well because it's very close to Wisconsin Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
Couple things. And he's going to talk about fraud, which we're going to get to in a second. But to me, given he's coming to a battleground state, I think we both agree that's what this is, Wisconsin.
I don't think that's up for debate.
Yeah. But I think he's setting the stage for a 2028 presidential run, if his boss lets him.
If he doesn't get in the way. That's also conventional wisdom, isn't it?
I guess. I mean, still.
I mean, I think the bigger question mark is who else. But I think
want me to name names? Rubio?
Yeah.
Ron DeSantis?
But Rubio said he's not sure.
Oh, come on. Why wouldn't you?
I don't know.
It's up for grabs.
Who gets Trump's endorsement?
That's the big question, right? And is that a stamp of approval? J.D. Vance coming to Wisconsin. He's obviously going to talk about fraud. It's an interesting question because as somebody who openly criticized, sorry for that microphone noise, openly criticized the DOGE efforts as not doing it the way it should have been done. Fraud is always a good thing to go after at all levels, all parts of society, public, private. Fraud is bad, should be prosecuted, and you should serve time if you are convicted, if that's what the penalty should be. It's interesting that we spend a lot of time talking about fraud when it comes to public programs. I think that's what he's going to talk about today.
Well, and that's what's, I mean, obviously, I think Mary Spicuzza has been doing a great job for years now as far as reporting on fraud of public programs, whether it's, you know, obviously in Minnesota, it was through different early childhood education. Here, it's been stuff for Medicaid. So of these different false claims for public programs, there has been an increased attention on fraud schemes, right? And I'm not arguing that we should not go after those things. We absolutely should. But it's also interesting that in the same vein, this is also an administration that has pardoned the most amount of people for fraud,
yeah.
Right? On my last list, there's like 22, I think, over half of the 88 individual pardons have been white collar for bank fraud, wire fraud, and money laundering. Those pardoned owed north of $298 million in fines and restitution combined. And in many cases, Trump wiped out the restitution too.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how can you hold both truths as far as,
is it
just because of the public money? But yeah, also, isn't tax evasion basically just the inverse of the same thing?
Yeah, evading taxes criminally is just as bad. Yes, I think it's the public thing is so much in our frame of reference because it's all anybody talks about, right? And it's sort of this overt persecution of people who are poor, right? So there are a tremendous number of programs that we are supposedly set up to help people that need assistance, which I think all of us are in favor of, right? We need programs to help people. Give them a helping hand. Shouldn't be something that they utilize for 50 years, but certainly help them up. And if you're talking about people of faith, basically built into your tenets of your faith. This preoccupation with one side versus the other side is frustrating. So if you're a corporate tax evader, a corporate criminal, you have the access to better lawyers, more money, you can get off, you don't serve jail time, but now we want to go after the people who are supposedly running programs that are helping poor people. We want to put them away.
And they probably will be put away.
Yeah. Cause they don't have good lawyers and they don't have money to fight these things. So it's a duality. It's a system that makes no sense. Fraud is bad. Whoever does it at any level, corporate, public, private, however you want to define it, it's all bad. But here's another thing. If I was coming to the state of Wisconsin, and I do think, and I know you want to talk about fraud, but I think this is...
No, we can go wherever you want.
I think this is a candidate for president. If I'm coming to Wisconsin, J.D. Vance, and I hope you're listening, or someone who works for you, if you pay attention to the media of the city you're coming to, how are you not talking about affordability in the state of Wisconsin or the country? And I know that your president, your boss, our president, doesn't necessarily like the term. He's used it a few times. This is a startling number. Recent polling, Harris poll. 95% of Americans believe the U.S. is suffering an affordability crisis. When's the last time you heard 95% on a poll?
That's wild.
That is, I almost swore, wild. That is wild. That's insane. If I'm coming to Milwaukee and I'm coming to Wisconsin, a battleground state, I'm going to mention affordability, but I bet you he doesn't mention it. Because he's coming here to go after fraud, which is what this administration, his president, our president, wants him to talk about. So a couple things. From a Republican perspective, you can attack my pedigree if you want to. I don't really give a crap. I want Republican candidates who speak the truth, who identify what the core issues are in any community in which they're speaking or any state they're visiting, and give us solutions and not complain about stuff endlessly with no resolution. Yes, fraud's bad. Yes, we should go after it. Seems like we are. Even in Minnesota, which was that big hoopla over all that stuff, Somali fraud, daycare.
But they were already going after it, even before the viral video.
In the previous administration, the Biden administration. If you want me to prove it, I'll send you the links. It sounds good. It's not real. If I'm coming to Wisconsin, I'm going to be pissed off about the fact that people can't pay for gas and groceries. Their health care costs are rising. Insurance costs are rising. Their home prices are rising.
Rent is rising.
Utility costs skyrocketing. As much as I care about fraud, and I do care about it, this is what people want to hear. And this is the part that the disconnect I don't get from a Republican perspective. There's a midterm election coming up. I want Republicans to win. But if you don't have a message that people are going to... They're not going to listen to the fraud thing. They want to hear about affordability.
Well, some people will. I think some people, because there isn't a, there, like, it triggers something, right?
He's going to get the 30%.
There is something that gets triggered when you feel like you're not getting what you owed or someone is cheating the system. But I do, that goes back to my thing with, like, who do you get angrier at when, you know, this idea that these people can be pardoned when it's numbers that are it's private money or whatever, but like it's like we don't hold the same standard
for
all types of fraud. But I agree as far as the focus of what should be talked about, especially because like we'll go to break in a second. But I did my first shift at Kinship last night,
right?
And like it was wild.
Tell people who it is, so they
know. Kinship is it used to be River West Food Pantry. Now it is a bigger program. That part of the program is still a food pantry, and it's around the corner from where I live. And so I finally had been wanting to start volunteering there. And I went last night for the first time. Shout out to Mike, who listens to the show, who's a 3 years running volunteer there.
Cool.
And it was my first time doing anything like that. And it is an interesting experience to see all of the walks of life who walk through that door needing help to get groceries.
Yeah. I hear from some of these people. I got a long email yesterday from somebody who was talking about this. There's two things he should mention. He probably won't. Affordability and the war in Iran, which is highly unpopular.
Still going.
And still going. We're going to get to that next. And, art of the deal, ? How's that working out? Weren't we in a memorandum of understanding? Wasn't that supposed to settle this all down? Recent comments from the president might indicate otherwise. J.D. Vance, if you're listening or your people are listening, affordability and the war, unpopular war in Iran, what are you going to do about it? You're a candidate for president. I guess, in a couple years. Quick break. Well, last I checked, we were in a sort of a ceasefire memorandum of understanding reality, but according to the president, the Iran ceasefire is over, and he says talks are a, direct quote, waste of time. Your thoughts?
I mean, he changes his mind a lot.
He does.
So
he does change his mind a lot.
It's... But if he's done, so let's play, he's like, they're scum, I don't want to deal with them anymore, he's over it. But that's not an end to the war, right? Like, there ultimately has to be other options as far as you started it, what is it going to take to finish it? Does it take conceding? Does it take what Bill's been calling for, which is just going in and, like, bombing them?
We're doing that right now.
I know, there's, like, tit-for-tat firing right now. And
right.
So
I get that. I put this in the notes. There's noble intentions here. We don't want them to be a nuclear superpower, right? We don't want them to have a nuclear weapon. But there was no strategy to verify that fact. There's no exit plan at all, that as far as I can tell. Iran's a powerful country. It's a big, large country in the Middle East. Lots of people. Hard to find things. if the goal was eliminating the threat of nuclear of a nuclear weapon, you better get that done. And they have not gotten that done. And I'm not sure what changes other than they're going to keep bombing them. But here's the thing. Tens of billion dollars in cost to the U.S. government to fight this war. Thousands of dead Iranians. Some people don't care about them. I care about anybody, any human life. Higher oil prices, inflation. I'm not equalizing these things. Inflation pressure. Middle East that's up for grabs in many cases, because who's assuming that this current leadership is going to be better than the last leadership? And they just escorted the body through the city recently. And again, if you're going to say we have a peace deal, at least a memorandum of understanding, like in June, which last time I checked is like last month, 60 days, it lasted like 2 weeks. So why would we, he was trotting around strutting the fact that he got this deal done. And here we are. He said it's over. He doesn't want to deal with them anymore. They're scum. It's the difference between having a fleshed out, detailed, organized plan and just wanting something with no way to get there. You know, for example, I'm going to build a skyscraper with no idea how to build anything, no idea of how to get the materials, no knowledge about structural integrity or what's safe and not, city codes, state codes, federal code. But I'm going to build a skyscraper. That's what this feels like to me. It's shallow. It's superficial, which how many times have I said that about this administration? Again, noble intentions. I don't want Iran to be a nuclear superpower. There aren't that many of them.
So at this point, is that the main thing we can gain? Like at what point does, or what would have to happen for this to have all been worth it?
Verifiable destruction of their ability to carry out a nuclear war. The facilities are gone. The enriched uranium is gone. Verified by whatever group, UN, whoever it is.
How much stronger would it have to be than what was under the Obama deal? Or how different would it have to be?
I think Obama tried to get there. I don't know if they ever accomplished that fact, because the storyline is that they've since that, you know, that era of the Obama administration, they still continue to do some things. At least that's what this administration is charging. Again, without verification, it's, you know, up for grabs. I think this is such a classic example. And the stunning thing is, for all the Trump supporters out there, this is a president who said he didn't like wars.
No new wars.
He also said he'd end the Ukraine-Russia war in one day, first day on the job. First thing I'm going
to
do.
Russia, coming back to the Olympics.
Yeah, how about that? Yay. Right? I'm a guy who believes in getting things done. And if his getting things done, he being the president, is that we are going to have a future Iran with better leadership and not a nuclear weapon, I don't think we're any closer. But we spent billions of dollars, lost 13 American lives, by the way. That's the last number I saw. And hundreds of injuries. That's real. And we have a lot of... last number I saw was 50,000 troops in the area. Whether it's Mikashin's send the troops in, you want to fight that kind? You want to fight a ground war in Iran? How'd that work out in Afghanistan? Not so well. The exit strategy there sucked as well under a different administration. I'm not a fan of this stuff. You can think these things, but unless you have a clearly detailed, organized, researched plan and exit strategy, you're just wasting our time. You're wasting lives and you're wasting money.
But we're already here.
We're here. We got to figure it out now. But I have no confidence that Hegseth or Vance or Trump or Stephen Miller or Susie Wiles, for God's sake, have any idea how to stop this.
You said you're halfway through regime change?
It's an interesting book.
Yeah.
The first quarter is learning why the people that work with the president are there. The Susie Wiles story. And a lot of these people have been around in his sphere of influence for a long time. I watched the interview with Anthony Scaramucci, who I didn't have a lot of respect for. The dude's smart.
He's really smart. He fills in on Pivot every once in a while with Kara Swisher when Scott Galloway's out. And he's I had no idea he was as bright as he is.
Yeah, he's also in love with himself. But that's, you know, egos are...
Anyone who gives themselves the nickname the Mooch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was raising money for Republicans and Trump for a long time before ever got in the White House. And he was actually, the story's pretty interesting, and I'm not going to tell him now, it's too long. But because Trump liked him, likes guys that raise money. He got his escort
in
the white.
10 awesome days he was in there until he was not.
The cool thing about Scaramucci, I'm not an advocate for him, but he understands how big of a mistake that was for him and potentially the country. That's the takeaway I got.
Did he sit for an interview for the book?
Scaramucci?
Yeah.
Not the part that I've read so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting question, though. All right, we'll take a break here. Lots more to talk about on Point Taken. She's Kristen. I'm Steve on 620 WTMJ. We're going to shift gears after the bottom of the hour news for you kids, 10:30. I'm intrigued, and I want to kind of know where people stand in this, because I've said for a while that the consumption, you've said this too, consumption of news is different. People go different places. They find sources that sort of agree with, or they agree with what the people are saying on those nets or those platforms. But the FCC has had a very aggressive tone under the chairman, Brendan Carr. He's sort of been the right-hand man of Donald Trump in some ways when it comes to media.
Is he still wearing the gold pin, the gold-headed pin of Donald Trump's bust?
I don't know.
He was wearing that for a
while. I thought you'd say butt.
Bust.
Because that would be more funny.
It would be funnier.
Why do you have Donald Trump's butt on pin? There? Yeah. Wouldn't that be funny? Anyway, so I want to kind of look, and I'm going to take you by the hand on this one, because this is like one of my topics. We're touching hands. I'm fed up with the way people are consuming media, and I think we can't just blame media. Start looking at yourself.
Oh, you're telling homework? Take responsibility?
Yeah. Just because you like something doesn't make you smarter. Just because you agree with them doesn't necessarily make you smarter or, you know, a better person. Sometimes a little disagreement is a good thing. So we're going to explore the world of broadcasting, how this administration, this FCC is changing the relationship and how it's impacting both radio stations, TV shows, networks, including The View,
which is on every day.
Yeah, we're
on our little four squad.
Whoopi and
very popular show.
Joy and
Matt Smith gave us inside knowledge that the phones ring off the hook when The View gets interrupted at our local WISN.
And my question would be, why? All right. All right, 10:35 on this Wednesday. Kristen Bryce, Steve Scavitti, it is Point Taken. You kind of know what we do here. I'm going to I'll make people mad, because I hear a lot of bitching about media a lot. People, even when I go out I was at a couple golf events in the last few weeks, and the media just, you know, they're always negative and blah, blah, blah. But I always say to people, you're choosing the way, the platforms that you consume, and you are favoriting these voices that you seem to agree with you. And last time I checked, some of these voices that agree with you on both sides, pretty negative, pretty anti-everything, pretty hate-filled, very aggressive, very violent in some cases. And I'd love to at some point share some of the emails that I get on a daily basis, or text on the text line, the Siding Unlimited WTMJ talking text line 855-616-1620. They're not all nice. But regardless of that, I don't care.
You're better at not caring than...
It's also because I think my age...
You've been doing it longer.
Yeah, it's just like... It's time to start understanding what we're doing here. So, the environment has changed. We went from traditional journalists, mostly men, just reading from either the teleprompter or the page, right? Here's the news of the day. They didn't editorialize unless it was identified as an op-ed. They just read the news. IBM hired 5,000 employees. Good news for the economy. And they go to their economic expert, 60-second clip, back to... And in weather news, you know, that kind of... I almost swore again. It's twice today. I almost swore. See, that's how passionate I am about this. And then the rise of talk radio. And we go back to the 80s through the Clinton era. I mean, that was Rush Limbaugh on, you know, Hillary's crazy husband, right? I mean, all the antics of the White House. We all know about it. Monica Lewinsky, who, by the way, she's a good follow.
She's a great follow.
I have mad respect for her because all the crap she went through. But anyway, that's a side channel. So that sort of changed the landscape. People started consuming radio because they listened to angry, mostly men, who they agreed with. And my words polluted their minds. Polluted their minds. Because we lost the ability to discern there was other ideas, a diversity of opinion. We want one thing. The other side's evil. They suck. This is what we should think. We're all going to groupthink that. And it sort of deteriorated civil debates, honest conversation, certainly impact on politics. We've seen the rise of, you know, populists in other countries and this country. So combine that sort of historical view of where we're at, groupthink, political cheerleading, that's, you know, really popular. And then you sort of weaponized the Federal Communications Commission, led by the current chair, Brendan Carr, who actively target providers. Quick example, San Francisco radio station KCBS.
I forgot about that one.
Yeah, early on reporting.
Early, I was like, that was...
Yeah, which is not
like
surprising.
Almost one of the first things back in like early 2025, before you and I even had a show together.
Yeah, they got threatened by Brendan Carr. What did they do about it? They didn't continue the aggressive reporting. They demoted one anchor. Began discouraging the reporters from pursuing political stories that could draw attention to the station in favor of human interest stories.
Well, no, it started because they were reporting on the local ICE efforts, the location of ICE.
Yeah. So that's one thing. Then I read this story about The View, which I'm not a big fan of The View. I understand it's been Barbara Walters created it as a news program.
Yeah.
It's sort of evolved into, it's a very popular show, as Matt Smith will attest when they try to replace it or delay it. They're now throttling back their political candidate bookings because of a threat by the FCC that we're going to, you know, look closer at what you do there.
Well, they're the argument of, as a talk show, do they fall under the equal time clause?
Equal time, yes.
And, you know, that can open up, I don't know if that's where you want to go in this conversation, is we're a talk show. Like what equal time is, and does it suffice if you invite everyone, but not everyone has to come, and all of these different rules? Because, you know, there's a lot of other shows that are talk shows that probably are not having everyone on
either.
Well,
talk is different than news.
Are they a news show or are they a talk show?
That's the question, right? And ultimately, if they're going to challenge it, it's going to be fought in court. But here's the thing. It's a 1930s regulation. Simply put, requires broadcast news programs to give equal airtime to opposing candidates if they allow one candidate for public office to appear on their airwaves. That's the rule. Talk is different. I don't necessarily follow that, but I do make the effort usually. Somebody always beats me up. Why don't you have Ron Johnson? I've offered through his people many times to Ron Johnson. Used to have him on all the time. We disagree on some things and how Republicans should look at things. And I think some of his ideas on healthcare are, how do I put this, stupid?
Little tinfoil hattie?
Yeah. Now, he would argue he's representing those who are ostracized or pushed away because they have alternate viewpoints of things. I'm still a science and data guy. You know, a micro percentage of somebody who might have some implication of something that was done health-wise that impacted them negatively. There's no guarantees on any health procedure. We all know that. We all sign that waiver. So to make that the story versus the 99.9% of people who are benefiting from health and science seems silly to me and stupid. But I'm curious, and this is the question I have for you. Do you, all of you out there in radio land, YouTube land, wherever you're consuming, do you like the new environment where it's just, you can just pick and choose? If you like left-leaning, you can go to MSNBC. I'm using the obvious examples. If you like Fox, Trump-loving Fox, you just go there because you can put the station on and hear all good things about the president, none of the bad stuff generally. Although they are starting to tweak them a little bit because they realize in 2028 it won't be President Trump anymore, or at least early 2029. How are you reconciling this? As a consumer of news, are you strictly just focusing on the stuff you like? And is that necessarily giving you a well-founded, well-rounded understanding of what's actually happening in our country, in our state, in our world? I don't think it is. And I know it makes you angry, and in some ways it's a sport to hate the other side. I would argue it's unintellectual, lazy, and is not helpful in the equation of... Because I think most of us, if we, on the 4th of July, recently celebrated 4th, we'd say, I want a better America. Wouldn't we all sign up for that? How are we getting there with this nonsense? That's my question. 855-616-1620. I want to hear your questions after the
break. We'll come back. But yes, let us know, how are you navigating the current media environment? 855-616-1620, and we'll talk more about that after this.
Lots of texts, which we love. Busy text day today on the Saturday Limited WTMJ Talking Text Line, 855-616-1620. Real quick before I let Kristen jump in here. The president lost recently a battle over things that people are saying about him in the press, and one of those was the Washington Post He had sued his, I say he, his social media company, Trump Media and Technology Group, Truth Social, all that stuff. $3.8 billion, picked a big number as far as the defamation lawsuit, but the a federal judge rules in favor of the Washington Post.
I feel like of the defamation lawsuits, it's just like throwing a dart at a dartboard of like, this is how much we're going to ask for. Because what was Cash Patel's against the Atlantic for when they started, they reported on how much he's drinking?
Yeah.
It was like $2 billion.
Yeah, just make up numbers.
How did you come up with this number?
I don't know. You can say whatever you want.
That story kind of just went away too.
Yeah. He's been quiet.
The head of our FBI is an alcoholic, and we talked about it for 2 days
and maybe
not concerned about it anymore.
Maybe the defense secretary as well.
So I want to talk about this. Of one of the, where did it go? I lost it. Basically, someone texted in saying, I listen to all types of media. I can't trust any of them.
Well, that's bad.
And it's hard because I want to know why you don't trust them. So if you were someone, whether you're the texter who texted that in or someone who also feels like I have a cynical view for all media, because it comes back to when we talk about trusting institutions, because as someone who works with journalists, I know at least like I know how committed these people are to the truth. Do they screw up sometimes? Are they on deadlines? So can they talk to everybody? Like, is there a human limitation on ever getting the true full story because of the fact that ultimately you have to go off, you write the story based off what you saw, who you talked to, and this is just the facts of what they are. And there's always going to be editorial, not editorializing in the writing, but editorializing in like what stories even get covered. Like when your editor says, go cover this versus this, like that is a decision of what is bigger, better, more important news. And so when you say you don't trust the news, what does that mean? Like, do you think that they are actively lying to you? Do you think that they're not telling you the full story? Do you think that they, I mean, this is they, it's like you don't trust any of them, that they're all just trying to manipulate and like propagandize you? What do you mean when you say you don't trust any media?
To me, it's the last part, manipulate and propagandize. On both sides. I mean, you know, there's networks established to do certain things about the left and the right. And I pointed out a couple examples earlier. I think people are just so comfortable now only listening to things that they agree with versus just listening to the news. Now, Texture made an interesting point. We have the big news, local news, 4-6, 12-58, local news.
Mm-hmm.
They trust them more than they do the national networks. And I think local news, especially in this market, does a pretty good job.
Absolutely. But the thing is with that is, and you think about news deserts, right? So like my parents in Wisconsin Rapids, their local news is out of Wausau.
Right.
And so that...
Nowhere close to Wisconsin Rapids.
Yeah, I mean, close-ish, but like, yeah. So they're covering how much of an area is that... those news stations trying to cover how many different stories for how many different communities are leaning on them as their local news.
How ironic it is that me, someone who works in the media locally here in Milwaukee and Wisconsin and talks about this stuff, my biggest news network now is the BBC. I actually subscribe to it.
It's because you're British.
I was born there. But I trust their journalism more than I do our journalists. I even listen to Piers Morgan, who's got great guests, but in many ways he's a whack job, but he has great guests. I like the way they're approaching it. They're trying to flesh out the full spectrum of a story from left to right. Every perspective is put in long form pieces that they call journalism. We're not getting that. We're getting a lot of shouting, a lot of, you know, pigeonholing of a story where it's, that's not really the whole story. I want to know the whole story.
But do you think that, like, when you watch, I mean, if you don't watch the nightly news with, like, John Muir?
Not anymore, no.
Is it because you don't trust what ABC is doing?
I just didn't find them that interesting. I used to watch all of them.
Okay.
I used to, this is my routine 7-8 years ago. I rewatched all of the, quick sampled all of the major news network news at 5:30. Then I watched the major networks, Fox and MSNBC and CNN at night, sampling their program. That's all I did at night. But at some point, it didn't make me smarter. And it was just consuming so much time.
Well, and it's interesting because the local news, and I say this as I have deep appreciation for what the local news does, but I also do think that like the criticism there's an over-reporting on crime, right? Like,
yes.
And because that, right, it bleeds, it leads. And so there is, and I think that goes back to what an editorial decision of what does our audience, what do we think our audience wants? And you know that because you have the data is what people are clicking on when you post it on your website or on Facebook. And so whether the policy debate that's happening in Madison, which is going to impact you more than this crime story that happened, but what is more, quote unquote, interesting and going to get more attention is the latter.
I'm glad you brought that up. I've been very critical of radio and TV in this market and elsewhere using that strategy. Do I care there's a car chase somewhere?
Unless, if it's going to affect your drive, maybe. If there's an accident that comes from
it's
it.
It's not like, about me.
Like, do I need to hear about the infant that was, like, drowned in a bathtub?
No. And should that lead the news?
Yeah.
And for too many stations here and elsewhere, it's just a blotter. Boom, this happened. Boom, this happened. Boom, this happened. Oh, then other news. Why did you lead with that stuff? Is it sexy?
Or is it low-hanging fruit? Because it's coming across the news
Ring
page.
A bell. That's it.
And you're it's like, all, well, we can just report on this if we have to. Like, it's like we got to keep moving.
Oh, let me read that police report. Let me read from that police
report. And don't get me wrong. The pressure of putting on a daily show.
It's hard.
Is hard. And so this is not a criticism versus because you also, if you have slimmer newsrooms that can't go out and do reporting on bigger issues and also turn those stories into visually interesting, for TV at least, visually interesting stories, which takes editing and work. Like, sometimes some of those things are just easier to turn around.
My suggestion for news producers, and you don't have to listen to me, and I know you're not going to, start thinking about doing news in a different way. Stop leading with the police blotter stuff. It sort of demonizes communities. It makes communities seem more dangerous, more violent, less safe. It's not helping. And as much as you talk about neighborhoods and, you know, we love our hometown, you're not starting your news programs that way. And I don't think that's a good thing. Quick break. All I'm asking is people to be smarter, better consumers. Listen better, be smarter. I know it's a big ask, and I know you don't want to change your habits, but we fall into these patterns of viewing and watching, and I like to mix it up. I read different books about different subjects. I watch different programs. I go through these. Right now I'm on a podcast phase, so I watch people doing podcasts from around the world. I don't know these guests in many places. I don't even know the interviewer, but I learn how people ask questions. I learn about things I didn't know before. That's the challenge for me as a consumer. It's not even necessarily news. It could be trends. It could be cultural topics. That is my thing, man. And the worst thing you could say to me is, I just like this. I don't want to change. It's just, that's lazy. I don't want to go there. Why would I go there? I don't know. Maybe you'll meet somebody nice. Maybe you'll see something you never saw before. That should be a good motivator. This, you know, again, I'll offend all the Friday night fish fry old-fashioned drinkers. Tell you what, go out for a steak and have a beer instead, you know?
Okay, is that your button for for this hour?
God, mix it up a little bit. Change it up. My God.
When we come back, we're going to be talking to Mark Sommerhauser, who is one of the researchers and communications director over at Wisconsin Policy Forum, because we're going to look at how Wisconsin's doing on 31 different topics. So stay with us. News is next.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Braun.
All right. Well, when was this? A couple weeks ago. I remember seeing this State of the States report.
I think we talked about it briefly.
We did talk about it briefly. And we tried to do some, like, kind of eyeballing analysis on where Wisconsin was. And it was across 31 different measures and under 14 categories.
Including economy, environment, which labor force, education, health, safety, all that stuff.
All this different stuff. And, you know, the reason why the report was published is basically, originally, states are supposed to be laboratories of democracy, right? Which I still have always loved that term. And the idea of all these different states that can try things out, different policies, different programs, different initiatives. And then as there's proof that they're working, other states adopt them. Maybe they get adopted nationally. And so by having a comprehensive look across all these different measures of which states are doing well in what, being able to then adopt those policies, or at least have the information if you want to adopt those policies. And so when you and I did this, it was kind of a off the cuff, like reading things in real time, trying to have some real time analysis. And then Wisconsin Policy Forum which are actually researchers and actually data experts, did the work for us as far as actually taking a deep dive into how Wisconsin is doing.
They crunched the numbers.
They crunched the numbers because, you know, they're good. They're good at that over there. And they're very good at also having, like, very sober, objective.
They're great at what they do.
They are great at what they do. And so their most recent report is looking into this bigger 2026 State of the States report. You can go to their website, wisconsinpolicyforum.org. It's the most recent research that they've published. And it's called Wisconsin Fares Well in Rankings, but Worsens on Some Measures. And so when we come back, we're still trying to get Mark Sommerhauser to join us to talk about more about what we can glean from this, about what Wisconsin is good at right now, where we're getting worse, and what can we learn from other states. So we're going to try to get Mark on the phone. You have something to add, Steve?
Yeah, just to have a general picture, we finished eighth.
Which is pretty good.
We're sandwiched by the Dakotas for some weird reason, North and South Dakota. Number one was Minnesota, which surprised me, actually.
That's because that's how I started the segment the last time we did it, was being like, you know, don't Minnesota my Wisconsin. It's like, well, there might be some things that we could learn from them.
And it does show us the power of data. So we all have opinions about Minnesota and Wisconsin. I certainly have strong opinions about Minnesota, especially Vikings fans. But looking at 31 different variables, Minnesota was number one. We were eighth, which, again, sounds really good. But as we'll hear from Mark Sommerhauser in a second here, there's some warning signs, especially on well-being, social, mental health stuff. Mm-hmm. So lots to think about.
But still, number one in trust of people.
Yeah, that's we focused on that one, which I still didn't understand.
Because you don't trust anybody.
No, I trust my wife. That's it.
You trust me
for the most part. Yeah,
depends on the day. Yeah. All right.
Don't put
back
a knife in her hands.
When we come back, we will have Mark Sommerhauser from Wisconsin Policy Forum. Stick with us. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bragg, along with always the always impeccable Steve Scafidi. And now we have Mark Sommerhauser on the phone with us from Wisconsin Policy Forum report, or forum, on their newest report, looking at a bigger report, 2026 State of the States. Welcome back, Mark.
Yeah. Hey, Kristen. Hey, Steve. It's good to be with you.
Good to have you. So it's funny because, as I was saying before, Steve and I saw this report when it first came out. We kind of looked into it, saw some of the headlines as far as Wisconsin was doing across all these different measures, but leave it to you guys to actually sink your teeth into it and tell us the important headlines that came out of what we can tell from Wisconsin from this report. So I will start with, what are we doing well right now?
Yeah, so the good news in these rankings is that it identifies a lot of measures in which we're doing well. This is a report that we did in partnership here with the State of the Nation Project, and they pulled together data on 31 different measures of things like the economy, the environment, labor force, education, health, safety, well-being, all these different areas. And they pulled together these data on 31 of these different measures for all 50 states, and then ranked them on each measure. And what we found is that Wisconsin is doing pretty well in several of these areas, and we're doing pretty well overall. Some of the strongest suits for our state are some of the measures of work and labor force. The one that we really highlighted in our report is our state's long-term unemployment rate. So that's kind of looking, obviously, you know, as the title suggests, at folks that have been unemployed for a period of time. And that's one where we're near the top, in the top 10. I believe we're ranking number six on that one. Among the states, and that's one where we've been kind of a leader for some time, and we do see a regional pattern with a lot of those work and labor force metrics where the upper Midwest generally tends to be near the top of the pack. Some of the other ones where we do pretty well, some of the measures of income inequality, we rank fourth among the states in income inequality, meaning, and just to be clear on that one, meaning we have less income inequality in Wisconsin than most other states. Also, when we look at the poverty rate in our state, we rank ninth. Again, that's meaning that our poverty rate is lower than the nation's. So that's, I think most folks would agree, that's kind of where we want to be, or at least close to where we would want to be relative to the other states in that measure. And then lastly, the one that we call out probably not a shock to your listeners, because again, this is one where Wisconsin has been above the national average for quite some time. Voter participation, that's measured here by voter turnout in recent elections, and our voter turnout rate continues to be quite a bit higher than the national rate.
Is it? This is speculative. Is it because we are a battleground state, or because people are just so motivated to vote, do you think?
It's a great question. I think there's probably some of both. We do see, once again, that voter participation tends to be, there are a lot of regional patterns here. The upper Midwest generally tends to be a high voter turnout region. And we do see pretty high turnout rates in some of our neighboring states that are not as much battleground states,
okay,
places like Iowa and Minnesota. So it's reasonable to think that might be having at least a marginal effect, but that regional dynamic suggests that maybe there is something else at play here.
So as a data person, as a researcher, because this is a report that is ranking states, so it is all relative, right? We're relative to other states. Yes. Is there on any of these 31 markers something, like, is there a binary of, like, good versus bad? Of, like, even if you are 25th, 45 are below where they should be ideally. Is there any analysis in that as far as what is succeeding look like regardless of where you rank?
That's a good question. I don't think this report really tries to look at these measures and say this is the benchmark that states should be above, and
okay,
if they're not above a certain benchmark, they're kind of not where they need to be. It's a good question, though. One thing that I will note is that there are several things, several dimensions here that this report looks at. It ranks, as we mentioned, it ranks each state on each of the 31 measures. And then it also provides data on which direction the state is trending. And that's something that we get, and we can talk a little more about what that means for Wisconsin, but that's really helpful because there are some of these areas where maybe a state is doing pretty well, but it's kind of trending in the wrong direction, or vice versa. Maybe it's not ranked as high, but it seems to be improving. And so that was kind of the other key piece to our analysis. And again, credit to the State of the Nation project, because this was really quite a lift, you know, to prepare all this stuff for all 50 states.
Mark Sommerhalder joining us from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. What do you make of the fact that 9 of the top 10 states by these rankings, Northern Midwest, Northern Great Plains, or New England, so are all north. What's the significance of that, do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the regional pattern is pretty apparent. If folks go to our website, wispolicyforum.org, they can click on the research tab and pull up the report, this report, which will be the first one that comes up. The first visual here that we have in the report is a color-coded map, of all the states. And you can see pretty clearly, the sort of dark green areas there in the upper Midwest and in New England as well. Listen, I think some of these measures, especially some of the strong suits that I just mentioned, we see that the other top 10 states in all those areas pretty much are in the upper Midwest and in New England. We talk a little bit in the report, this was kind of one of our shorter focus reports, and so we didn't have the capacity to kind of get into, well, why are these regional patterns existing, or why is Wisconsin ranked so highly? It's possible that there could be some demographic factors at play in the sense that some of these measures are going to probably benefit states, for instance, that are a little older than the average. Our median age in Wisconsin is a little older than the nation. And we know that older folks tend to vote at higher rates. They tend to have higher rates of labor force participation, some other things. So that could be affecting at least some of these measures. However, the fact that Wisconsin has been pretty strong in a lot of these areas going back several decades, including when our population was not necessarily older than the nation, suggests that that's probably only a marginal effect on a few of these measures, and there's probably something else at play here.
All right, so when we come back, I want to, because in your report you said there's some indicators that our strong standing could be at risk, so I want to get into that.
Yep.
After this is Point Taken, and we're talking to Mark Sommerhalder from Wisconsin Policy Forum. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen, he is Steve, and we're talking to Mark Sommerhalder from Wisconsin Policy Forum, talking about their deep dive into how Wisconsin is faring according to the 2026 State of the States report. You can check it out at wisconsinpolicyforum.org. Now, so part of this was, I mean, top 10, pretty good as far as Wisconsin is measuring on average across all these different measures, but also noting that some of our strengths, We could be losing as far as what you were talking about with the trend lines of where we're going. And so what were some of the cautions or the red flags that you guys saw that we should be aware of, especially as like policymakers and lawmakers are thinking about this?
Yeah, so that was one of the major themes for our report, is that while we're doing pretty well overall, there are more of these measures where we are slipping than where we are ascending. In fairness, part of that is probably just a function of the fact that we do rank highly in some of these areas. There's not much room to go upward in some of these areas, and it's difficult to, you know, maintain a sort of leadership position in some of these areas. So I want to be fair about that. But when we looked at all 31 of these measures, we're relative to the nation, we are worsening on 13 of them, improving on 8 of them, and the remaining 10 were kind of have a mixed or stable trajectory in terms of our trend relative to other states. So that's not great in the sense that we're kind of getting worse on more of these areas than we're improving. Something that you see time and again as you go through each of these individual measures is that there's a lot of these areas where we have been stronger than the nation for a long time, going back several decades. And we, in many of these areas, are still better than the nation, but we're kind of losing ground. We're kind of slipping relative to where the nation is, such that we're still ahead of the curve, but not by as much. And, you know, some of these specific areas that we highlight in our report, labor force participation rate, again, that's one where we're doing pretty well, but we're not leading by as much as we used to. Fatal shootings is one of the two measures of violence in the report. And again, that's a similar story where our rate of fatal shootings is lower than the national rate, but we're kind of converging toward the nation and not really going the direction that we'd want to go. And then lastly, the third one that we highlight in that category, newborns who are born with low birth weight. As many of your listeners probably know, that's associated with, you know, all kinds of developmental issues for newborns after they're born. And that's one where, once again, we are kind of slipping relative to other states. So that was kind of one of the major themes that we highlighted.
Explain the trust thing to me. We don't trust federal government, according to this study, but we immensely trust each other. How's that jive?
Yeah, so that one, to be honest with you, had us scratch our head a little bit as well. And we didn't highlight it perhaps quite as highly as we might have, just because it is a little more subjective in the way folks answer those types of questions in a survey, right? Whether they trust other people, whether they trust the federal government, it was definitely striking to us that we're near the top, apparently, right. And the extent to which we trust other people, presumably, I guess that means, you know, other people in our community, other people that we interact with, but we're near the very bottom in terms of the level of trust that we have in the federal government, according to this survey that was used. And so it was, I thought, a striking contrast. I agree with you, Steve.
All right. So one of the other things as far as our weaker points, so we covered what we're good at, where we're slipping, and then there's some things that we actually are weaker on. And it also kind of feels in the face of just saying how much we trust each other, where we are with volunteerism.
Yeah.
Like, we're middle of the pack. We're not like bottom half, but so we're ranked 25th. No, we were ranked 25th in 2023. And where are we right now? Yeah.
2023 actually is the most recent year for which we have data on that particular
metric. So we're 25th, yeah. But as far as, I don't know, for some reason I thought our volunteerism would be higher.
Well, the reason you thought that is because it used to be. You know, traditionally we have been a very high volunteerism state. And so that's kind of, the good news again for Wisconsin is that there's very few of these measures where we're near the bottom. Most of the measures that we highlight as kind of some of our weaker areas actually are ones where we're not terrible. We're kind of middle of the pack, or maybe a little behind middle of the pack, but we're kind of trending in the wrong direction. And the volunteerism is a perfect example of this, where we're not doing terribly. We're ranked 25th in that measure. But if you go back and look historically, our volunteerism right now is about pretty close to the national average. It used to be far above the national average if we go back 10, 15, 20 years. And so that's another example of like not really trending in the right direction there. We used to be kind of a national leader in volunteerism, and we're kind of converging toward the national mean in that area.
All right. Well, there's lots to dig in here. Like I said, go to wisconsinpolicyforum.org to read more about this. Mark Sommerhauser, as always, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be back. No, we have 10 seconds.
Yeah. We've still got a half hour. I don't even know what we're doing. We'll have to think about that during the news break. Newsroom's paying attention to the sentencing hearing for former Judge Hannah Dugan. If we have any breaking news on that, we'll certainly update you on that, and certainly at the top of the hour. On 620 WTMJ, this is Chris, and I'm Steve. I've said this before, one of my favorite websites, I used to use it a lot more than I do now, is studyfinds.org. It's just a lot of different studies about a lot of different things, from science, wellness, food, lists, newsletter stuff, even games, if that's your thing. But this one caught my eye because we spent a considerable amount of time on this program talking about artificial intelligence, AI, and its impact on the workplace, each other, how we see things on the internet, videos, fake news. And I saw this headline, and this is a serious problem. I'm actually going to do a podcast on this, hopefully, if I get the permission of a medical provider to talk about young people and mental health. More than 9 out of 10 young people say AI advice helped, but experts urge caution. So what are they talking about? About 1 in 5 American teens and young adults, roughly 8 million of those people, reported using AI chatbots for mental health advice in the last year, 2025. Significant increase. Here's the part that's troubling, and I verified this with a psychiatrist friend. Nearly two-thirds of those kids, primarily, kept it secret from everyone, including their parents, friends, and their doctors.
So that's what I'm interested in this report. So they answered yes on a survey.
Yeah, but didn't tell their parents.
Which
is sort of revealing, right?
And that, I do think that is the bigger storyline of trusting a robot more than you trust anyone in your life to ask certain questions.
Yeah, once a month is like the average. And this is the people that admitted to it. And there's always that, you know, gray of, okay, who's not going to, even if they do and they're not going to say, and with going to your point. Interesting that 9 out of 10 also said that they find that advice helpful, even though if you go on a ChatGPT or any AI site, it will tell you at the bottom, some of this may not be truthful. I'm paraphrasing.
Well, it's not even that it's not truthful. A lot of it is programmed to be agreeable.
Yeah, algorithms and the like.
And so is it, and I don't know, because if it's helpful, it's helpful.
Okay.
And I know in the report, pediatricians and mental health experts for young people question what that is. But I struggle with this because on its face, I don't think it's good, right? I think we should try to build up trust, and young people should have trusted adults, if that means beyond their own parents, yes, coaches, counselors, teachers, Boy Scout leaders, all the different things as far as having trusted adults in their life that, or even trusted friends that they can talk to about stuff face to face in real life. I think that is still the ideal. There is clearly something missing, that there is like shame around what they feel like they want to talk about, that they feel much more comfortable doing that via a chatbot that is not a sentient being than a real human being. So like there is a disconnect there that absolutely needs to be talked about and handled. The other part of this is, if they're also reporting it's helpful for them to talk to anybody, is that better than not talking to anything at all?
That's a great question. And like I said, I'm just starting to get into this arena of conversation about AI and its impact on mental health. Doctors are concerned because if they're getting it there and they're not telling their doctors, they have no ability to correct whatever is misinformation, provide more context, all the detail that matters when you're having an important conversation like that.
Well, it's also, I mean, because there's also there's a times that it's not helpful, right? Because there has been, I think OpenAI, that's one of the lawsuits against them right now, is the fact that there was a child who died by suicide after consulting with ChatGPT like chatbot, as far as what the advice was, where the conversation went, and the control over that, especially with minors, is part of the like one of the major lawsuits coming up against them right now.
It's my biggest problem with all of these sort of things, ChatGPT and AI and social media platforms, the access of some very young children or young people to information they can't process. Their brains are still being formed, right? That process continues in your early 20s. And they're, in some cases, trusting these platforms and this information. That's I don't think anyone, and this is anecdotal, I'm just going to say it. I don't think anyone thinks our mental health as a country is getting better. I don't think so.
Well, no, I don't think our mental health is getting better. And I was talking in this conversation, full disclosure, talking to my husband about some things that I am dealing with. And he was like, well, have you ever thought about going back to therapy? And honestly, sometimes, because I've gone, I certainly went a lot during my 20s. But the barrier, not the barrier to entry to even find a therapist, but also finding, because it's such an intimate relationship.
Oh, yeah.
And like the trial, it's not just like going to a doctor that's like a primary care doctor where they can diagnose what you have. And sometimes there's a fit and sometimes there's not a fit, but it's a little bit more straightforward than finding someone that you feel like you jive with for mental health that like challenges you in the way that you want to be challenged. And like has that relationship, and it's not cheap. And so how many rounds of sessions do you go through before you're like, I don't really know if this is working? Because ultimately you kind of have to get to know each other a little bit. So there's a little bit of a time investment, let alone a monetary investment, only to then kind of feel like, this isn't working. And so then you go find another person. And so as a busy person, even finding a good therapist sounds daunting, let alone be having access to one financially or with your health insurance or even availability because there's a shortage. And so I do understand at your fingertips, having someone, even if it's a robot, to get things off your chest with.
Yeah.
But but there is inherent danger as far as what advice they give back and how seriously you take it.
I'm going to fall on the side of parents and mental health professionals because the risk, in my opinion, is too great. If it's providing what the kid wants to hear or stuff that's just not true or misleading, that can have serious implications. And I get the point about, well, what else do they have? And one wishes that everyone had easier access to someone that they could talk to. And maybe this is where schools, they often have mental health professionals on staff. Some do, some school districts. And I think that's a good thing. Maybe that's where it starts. But, I mean, parents are tasked with raising their children. And part of raising your children is make sure they're, you know, thinking things through properly and understanding the context of what they do. This all comes down to one of the things I've been very vocal about, and that's access to all of these things. Easy access by people who maybe shouldn't have access to it, or unlimited access when they should have very limited access. And we have to fix this. And this continued brick wall that says, no, it's the same question. I listen to a lot of radio. Well, how are we going to do that? And then just give up. You got to find a way to do it. You have to work with the providers. You have to understand that there's a role for legislators. But you have to answer the how question. Because if you don't, you're just giving up. And as much as there are incredible things available on the internet, some of the stuff is crap, and some of it is potentially dangerous. And that's what I fear. So we figure out the answer to the how question, even if it's hard.
Do you feel like the how question is the similar, like what they're doing with social media in the UK and Australia? Is it like an age limit?
Yeah, they're trying to figure it out. And what are we doing? We sort of did that on phones, right? Limiting access to smartphones in school. It's happening across the states. It'll be fully in effect in the fall. And strong, I think, leadership by the legislature, by elected officials and school districts saying, let's do something. Mm-hmm. They've answered to some degree the how question. But this goes well beyond that, and that's why I wanted to bring this up.
Oh, we got to go break. I was going to say, it is interesting, though, because when you have personal MacBooks and Apple Watches, all the messaging and stuff is still at your fingertips.
Absolutely. And that's another reality. You have all this technology. What are we going to do with it? We paid all this money. And I can tell you a story. I'll tell you during the break.
All right.
About someone that bought all that stuff and then just stacked it up in a closet somewhere because they weren't using it. Interesting.
Interesting.
Break.
I'm Matt Dorner, CEO of Milwaukee Downtown Bid 21. Our business leaders value downtown Milwaukee.
We practice law locally, regionally, nationally, and even globally. But downtown Milwaukee will always be our home. I'm Susan Lovern, CEO of Umbreson and Roper. We've enjoyed watching downtown grow for decades, and we're thrilled to be part of its bright future.
Get down to business at MilwaukeeDowntown.com.
Hey, it's WTMJ, Steve Scavitti. Joint pain is awful when you're the person who's fighting through it, but I'm betting you aren't the only ones impacted by it. Maybe you love someone who struggles with joint pain, but you see what they don't see. They You feel that, what they slowly stop doing. It's July. You want to be outside, right? Moving, playing, living, having fun, and you're sitting it out. At QC Kinetics, I'm also a patient and a spokesperson, by the way. That's what's happening every day. They fixed my elbow for me last year. Five treatments changed my elbow reality, and no pain. You can see on YouTube, working just fine. People who are stuck in that cycle of pain, hips, knees, shoulders, back, elbows, whatever it is, they're finally stepping out of it with regenerative treatments like I received, done right there in their office, Mequon and Greenfield. No surgery, no long recovery, or putting your life on hold. Why? Just real relief. Inflammation goes away. Pain lets go. We hear it all the time, not just from patients, but the people around them. He's back. She's herself again. So if this sounds like you or someone you love, go find out what's possible. I did. You should too. QC Kinetics offers a free consultation to their great communicators as well as medical providers. See if you're a good candidate. Call QC Kinetics at 414-667-5559. That's 414-667-5559. Interesting, talking about AR, artificial intelligence. We're all using it at work now for the most part in a lot of different ways. But, I mean, it's no surprise that, and Kristen, you're younger than I am, that young people, they find this stuff. They seek it out. You know, I remember what I was like as a teenager. I was screwed up in the head. I was thinking about all kinds of crazy stuff. You know, I'll be completely honest. I didn't have harmful thoughts, but just you're not focused because your hormones are crazy. You discover girls are a thing. It's like, damn.
Searching for stacks and magazines somewhere.
Yeah. So it's a whole different reality. Why would we think today's teens or young people are any different? And there's so many influences that we didn't have, the internet and, you know, smartphones that are always with them. And, you know, back in the day, which is many, many years ago, no phones other than the one that was wired to your wall. You generally had one. You didn't certainly have a phone where you were. You checked in with your parents in the morning. You checked in for dinner time. That's the only time they contact you. Now people are texting each other all day, parents and kids. It's just different.
It's definitely different.
And I would argue, and then again, anecdotal, I'm not a medical professional, all this technology has not lessened the impact of all of that technology on our mental health.
We're more
screwed up.
It's probably worse. I think that's, so this is what I'm working on. This, can't wait. I wonder how many of our listeners will actually watch the documentary when it's done after an entire full year of me talking about it or referencing it whenever it's applicable. But that is, as I'm trying to court, like go through 80 some, we interviewed over 80 people. There's 54 transcripts. And as we're trying to collect the patterns here, like the biggest thing that sticks out to me is how much younger and how much more politically aware almost everyone we talked to was.
Mm-hmm.
And even people who like don't really care about politics, but like it shows up on their phones, it shows up in their schools, shows up in their family.
There's a but on this though, right?
And so it's like there is so much more awareness. There is so much more information. And without any tools to feel like, what is the thing, like action is the antidote to despair or something along those lines. There's variations of that, of the influx of constant information that makes you feel hopeless, because it's like you know a lot, but you're like, what do I do? And I think that is part of the anxiety and depression of like knowing more than you probably should.
Yeah, it's like all this information, what the hell am I supposed to do with it?
Knowing more than we were wired to comprehend.
Especially at the age of 13 or 14. I don't know how it is being a teenager now, but it can't be easy. So I'm not gonna blow them up. It's got to be difficult.
On that note, on the 4th of July, we were at a buddy's house, and his sister was in town from Seattle. So I was making small talk with her, and I was like, what do you do? She said, I'm a therapist. I said, what's your specialty? She said, teenagers with eating disorders. I'm like, oh, I had one of those. She goes, me too. And I was like, how are the kids doing? And she goes, not great, man. She goes, like, all of the made up theories I had as a teenager of what people thought about me, they are now living with it being confirmed every day because of what happens and how people are looking at them, the comments they're making on their pages and all these different things. And I was like, because she's my age. There's a very different reality than even I did 20 years ago.
Yeah. I haven't even mentioned this, but think about the young people sending images of their each other back and forth. Like it doesn't matter. And then come back to haunt them later on. And they, then they suffer those consequences, and often that impacts their mental health, and they make really bad decisions based on a bad decision they made to send a picture. Stuff matters, and we got to start thinking about these things. That's the only reason I brought it up, because it's a big, big topic. That's why I'm going to do some stuff on the Scootyology podcast with a mental health professional who can sort of break it down, the relationship between technology, kids, and their parents, and how we shape the future conversations. Final break. Point taken. 620 WTMJ. All right, some breaking news for you before we get to the top of the hour news that we do every top of the hour here on WTMJ. Former Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Hannah Dugan has been sentenced to no prison time for obstructing an ICE arrest in a county courthouse. The judge, Lynn Edelman, said, "This defendant is 67 years old with no prior record. I don't think she has any correctional services needs. She has a lifetime of service to others. This is a person who has done a lot of good in our community. This is a situation where an otherwise good person made a bad decision in the moment." From the judge.
I think this is... With 10 seconds left in today's show...
Go ahead.
A bigger philosophical question over what is prison for. Maybe we can talk about it tomorrow.
Sounds good. She's Chris and I'm Steve. Point taken.
Are you worried about running out of money in retirement? Wondering about how to pay less taxes? Join me, Tony Drake, for the Retirement Ready Show, live every Saturday at noon and Sunday at 7 a.m. on WTMJ 620 or 103.3 FM. We'll talk about smart strategies to help you retire with confidence. Don't miss it.
Drake & Associates, LLC is an independent investment advisory firm that offers a variety of different investment vehicles. This commercial is provided for informational purposes only and should not be considered as individual investment advice. Drake & Associates, LLC does not provide legal or tax advice. Past performance is not indicative of future performance.
The historic Fox and Hound Supper Club is the most beautiful, unique, and affordable summer dining destination. WTMJ's John Merck here. I love the Fox and Hounds. When you buy one dinner, your second dinner is free, including prime rib every Wednesday and Saturday, desserts and ice cream drinks, buy one, get one free. Order a hand-cut choice ribeye steak, pan-seared scallops, the roasted duck, pan-fried walleye, pasta, the ribs, any entree, your second dinner is free. 7 nights a week. Wow, what a value. Relax with a cold beverage on that patio in the woods, then dinner in one of the 8 unique dining rooms. Your second dinner is free. It is a dining experience at the historic Fox and Hounds. The award-winning Fox and Hounds Supper Club off Highway 167 near Holy Hill. The drive through the Kettle Moraine is stunning. A Wisconsin summer must-see. Wherever you live, it's worth the beautiful drive and free dinner at the Fox and Hounds. So step away from your kitchen, call and reserve your free dinner today. It's the famous Fox and Hounds.
Shopping for new windows and doors shouldn't feel like a negotiation. Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin doesn't believe in games. They never inflate pricing, and there's no high-pressure sales pitch. Just premium windows and doors built for long-term comfort, beauty, and peace of mind. Buy direct through Pella, and one trusted team handles everything with Pella-certified installers every step of the way. Real pricing, premium quality, no games. Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Schedule your free in-home consultation today at PellaWI.com.
You already know that Kessler's is the world's largest employee-owned group of jewelry stores.
We were recently told that Kessler's is the fastest-growing group of jewelry stores in America.
Well, it just goes to show you.
Show you what?
That people like to feel good.
What do you mean?
Rick, you know how many people will drop by and look in the showcases and have some coffee and chat with their sales associates?
Yes.
That doesn't happen at other stores.
Really?
People come to Kessler's because it brightens their day.
It makes them feel good.
It certainly makes me feel good.
Tell me why.
Well, everyone's always in a good mood. And everything is clean and sparkling and romantic and happy.
It feels like sunshine and rainbows, doesn't it?
Sarah, that's exactly what it feels like.
When you're having a gray day, come to Kessler's.
Have some coffee and let us clean your jewelry.
Our jewelry cleaning equipment is completely different than what you have at home.
And we're delighted to do it for free, of course.
Welcome to Kessler's.